be this technical conference. For your information, we are both doing the call-in number that hopefully was sent out to you, as well as we are streaming live via the internet. For those who are just listening via streaming, if you would like to comment, you may send me an email, and I will read your comment so that it can be discussed by the parties. And my email address you can send that to is my first two initials, the letter J, followed by the letter S, like Sam, my last name Harvey, at utah.gov. So that's how you can participate if you're listening by streaming. Commission would like to express its appreciation for all of the work that the parties have done in their comments. We have read them all. We have considered them. We've been impressed with the level of detail and the ideas that were expressed. We'd like to thank you for that. We do note that we have one commissioner attending in person, Commissioner Dave Clark. The other two commissioners are participating via the streaming. We don't want to have a quorum and get into trouble or anything like that. So that's what we're doing there. I think we have enough people here now that we can go around and do introductions to get some idea of who's here. We'll start with the folks in the room, and we'll then move to the folks on the bridge. If anyone is participating only via the streaming, they can send me an email and I'll announce who they are as well. So to begin with again, my name is John Harvey. I'm technical staff with the commission.
Melanie Reif, administrative law judge for the Utah Public Service Commission.
Carl Searle, Stratton Networks.
Curis Lawson from Blackburn Install on behalf of URTA.
Jim Farr, CenturyLink.
Pam Hankins, CenturyLink.
Tori Summers with CenturyLink.
My name is Sharon Bertelson. I'm from Ballard's Bar, and I'm representing Virgin Mobile.
Cheryl Murray, Office of Consumer Services.
Rosalind DeSosie with the Utah Telephone Assistance.
Kathleen Bonas, the Department of Workforce Services.
Shauna Bevenu-Springer with the Division.
Bill Duncan with Division Public Utilities.
And Justin Jenner with the Division.
David Clark with the Public Service Commission.
All right. Okay, and for those on the phone, I've heard a few come on, but why don't we start with AT&T, and we'll try to go somewhat alphabetical to organize it.
This is Roger Moffitt. I'm counsel for AT&T. There are a number of AT&T people. I'll let them state who they are, since we're different locations.
Okay.
Janet
Mono, AT&T. Okay. Hi, John. This is John Sizemore at AT&T. Okay.
This is Ian Bornholm at AT&T.
Anybody else from AT&T? Okay, and then I didn't hear anyone else coming on, but if there's anyone else on the bridge, please introduce yourself. Okay, who was
Tom Nails, CenturyLink.
It was Carol Dillstrap, CenturyLink, and Tom Nails.
Oh, okay. Anyone else on the phone?
Parachute with iWireless.
Anyone else? Okay. Well, thank you for your attendance and participation. Let me give you just a little bit of a, not outline, but just a description of the method we'd like to use today, and also talk about the purpose. As I mentioned earlier, the commission and the commission staff have read all of the comments, and we'd like to do today primarily is make sure that we have a good understanding of the various parties' positions. We do not plan to make decisions or make any final determinations today. Parties are certainly, as always, free to talk and amongst themselves and come up with any suggestions they would like for the commission, if you're so inclined to do that. But we would not plan on either necessarily defending anything or deciding anything today. It's mainly to try and understand the comments. Now, that being said, there are a few issues that we want to explain sort of where we are constrained, because we don't want to necessarily spend time talking about things that we effectively don't have control over. So we do need to clear a few of those out at the very start, but then from then on it would probably primarily just be a discussion and an explanation. So to begin with, for the role of DWS, Department of Workforce Services, there were a number of comments expressing the desire for them to take on a bigger role or criticizing certain aspects of their defined role. We need to get on the table right out front that they are a separate agency from the commission. We can't determine or order them to do anything. They are participating with the Lifeline program because they have agreed to do so, not because we can order them to do so. And as such, their participation is subject to the constraints that they operate under. And primarily the issues they've expressed to us are concerns over privacy of their records and who they feel can't have access to those records. And so their participation is predicated upon the idea that they are going to be the only people with access to those participation program records. So the idea of having real-time access by the carriers, that's not an option that's going to be on the table simply because of the way that Department of Workforce Services interprets the laws and the rules that they operate under. So that's not something that we plan on pursuing. But other than that, I think pretty much everything in the role, we're certainly open to hearing people's opinions and ideas and would like to do so. So the way that we propose to proceed is simply to go through the role section by section, and people can explain issues, concerns, ideas that they have. When we've gotten all the way through the rule, we will certainly open it up to any general comments, things that we may have missed, things of, you know, whatever other concerns the parties may have. Depending on how long it appears that the meeting is going to go, if we don't seem to be substantially through the process by about 10:30, we'll probably take a short personal break and then resume, but certainly would plan on being done by sometime around lunchtime unless something really bizarre happens. But I'm guessing by then most of you will definitely want it to be done.
We'll be worn out.
All right. So with that said, we can begin talking about first few sections, I guess. So to begin with, on just the very first section, the rule of applicability, I'm assuming that we all agree that this basically applies to ETCs, but any comments on section one that anybody's?
CenturyLink have one suggested change that uses the term Lifeline telephone service, that we suggested a change to say voice telephony service that would match the federal USF guidelines and is probably a broader term than voice telephone service or
voice telephone service. And what we would like to know as a commission is what when you're talking about being broader, what does that encompass that this current terminology doesn't?
I'm probably not the expert on that, but I know that their rules further define various things that are covered by, and I can look it up, but that by that term. But it would cover, like, for instance, VoIP services, which might not fall under the definition of telephone. The technology has evolved so that there are different ways to transmit voice, and I believe that's the reason why they chose to change the federal rules.
If you could possibly submit to us just the federal reference on that, and then okay. We can sort of examine that. Are there any other parties that have an opinion on that definition of the telephony versus the telephone?
If I could just add to that for CenturyLink as well, one thing we have found working on these lifeline rules in other states is it being particularly helpful to try following certain federal definitions as much as possible so there's consistency. I know it makes it much easier for us as a carrier to implement, and things become very complicated when states have even slight differences in definitions and in certain procedures. So as much as possible, if we follow the federal rules as well.
Well, and one of the, just for the parties, I guess information, for lack of a better word, one of the issues the commission is, having to think pretty hard about is currently when we look at our rules and our programs, there are some differences, obviously, between the state program and the federal program, and so we are considering those types of issues, certainly. All right, anything else on that first one? That's probably the easiest one we're going to bump into. Just giving people a last chance there, okay. All right, section number two, definitions. I can let parties know that there were a number of, well, you probably have read the comments too, but a number of parties said we should include NLAD as one of the defined terms, and that certainly makes sense, so don't worry about making your case for that one, we're convinced. But other things in the definition section that people would like to comment on? Yes?
Kiros Lawson with URTA. I have a concern on the definition of applicant, meaning an ETC customer who legally resides in the ETC service area. I think that the rules sort of make a distinction between an applicant and a subscriber or participant. I mean, a lot of people can apply who would not necessarily be participants.
Right.
And so I had suggested that perhaps applicant should mean an ETC customer who completes an application for Lifeline service. I know there's other people who have commented that the definition should be something other than that on applicant, but that makes sense to me because it seems to me that a person who applies for Lifeline service as defined in the rules is an applicant.
Okay. Other comments on the definition of applicant?
Yeah, one of the problems that we faced during recertification was that sometimes there are people that are residing maybe outside the boundaries of the state of Utah, but they are applying for service within, because either they are part-time residents in Utah, they live in Utah, maybe part-time, and then they're in Arizona for another part of the year. So we need to define how that is arranged with residency.
Okay, so residency is an issue. I know that some of the comments talked about whether we need legally in there, and then the URTA in terms of filling out the application, but any other nuances or ideas there?
This is Roger Monson for AT&T.
Yes.
And I appreciate the issue of residency you're identifying, but isn't that addressed to some degree by requiring compliance with the federal rules? I mean, they have built into them certain requirements about, I believe, residency, and when you do your certification and your entitlement to seek, correct me if I'm wrong, but just kind of following up on Tori's comment from earlier, which I think is well taken, we'd like as much as possible to simply incorporate federal rules for purposes of uniformity. And if it can be addressed simply by incorporating federal rules, we would far prefer that rather than trying to write in a separate state requirement to that.
And I guess what I was trying to address was the Utah discount subsidy. For those receiving Utah discount subsidy, they should be residing in Utah, not necessarily in Arizona or other places.
And wouldn't that go to whether they are move from applicant status to participant? I mean, you're not going to stop people. I think you're still going to have people applying, and they're going to have to be called something. But then once they become a participant, they're not going to become a participant unless they're residing in the state of Utah. So I think you want to talk about adding a definition of participant, or I guess we've got one in here.
You do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because the FCC, the customer can get one discount. Okay, and so if they actually reside in both states, you know, different times of the year, what you want to decide is, okay, what do they need to do to qualify for the Utah discount? Because they could get the federal discount, but let's say that they're in Arizona 8 months a year and they're here 4 months. I mean, is that what you're trying to get at?
And then does that mean they have two households?
Yeah.
Because they have, you know, they're living with their children or something, maybe, you know, part of the time, and then their own household part. I don't know. I mean, it just raises a number of issues.
Well, if that's the case, and I can understand why you would want to have that separate requirement just for that purpose, but in that event, wouldn't you want to write it for that specific purpose and not write it in as a general legal requirement where it may have a broader application than you're intending?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were trying to just identify the Utah subsidy that would apply to them. And how does residency qualify? How do we define residency to qualify?
And I think, to Roger's point, I think if you're going to do that, I think it's much better rather than trying to put that in the definition of applicant to somehow have a separate section dealing with residency. Okay. But I'm just trying to figure out when this would happen, because under that scenario, is someone then applying for federal USF in the other state and only the Utah credit here? If they're applying for the Utah Lifeline credit here, in most situations, wouldn't they be applying for the federal Lifeline here as well?
Yes, and then we find out that they've got residency in Arizona, and they're getting an Arizona subsidy.
But that's the whole part of all of what we're doing now, is to make sure someone's not getting two Lifeline credits.
Right.
But the NLAD
should help them back.
Should pick up that.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, but they can only get one federal credit. So if they say their primary residency is Utah, and they get the federal credit, they get the state credit. And even though they may not be living here, you know, they normally keep their phone service going.
Right.
So
what we're saying is we want to add within the boundaries of Utah if you're getting the Utah subsidy.
I guess, but is another way to handle it to simply indicate you can't get the Utah credit unless you're getting the federal Lifeline credit here, and that way you're dealing with all potential for duplication.
Right.
If you just say, look, you're not getting the Utah Lifeline credit unless you're also getting the federal credit here, and then it's going to be much easier to track.
Right.
And then you don't have to deal with the residency issue.
Right, and that's what we wanted to clarify.
And trying to find it exactly, but we have a requirement for our state ETCs that they have to participate at the federal program, so that may be covered.
but we can certainly.
Well, the ETC could participate in the federal program. I guess the customer is, where are they going to get the federal credit? That's where you manage the state credit. So if they get it in Utah, then they can also qualify for it. Because in essence, they're saying this is my primary residency.
Right.
And then you don't have to get into all trying to determine whether right. they're here so many months of the year.
Right.
Right, because they couldn't say that their primary residency is in Arizona to get the credit in Arizona, and then come here and say their primary residency is in yeah. Utah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They can't get the federal credit in Arizona and Utah at the same time.
Right.
Right. In which case, I think it's easier to tie it to simply the federal credit.
But aren't yeah. we getting into a situation, too, where somebody could move from one state to the other and keep their phone number?
Yeah, they can port it.
And then, is that some of your concern? Is that maybe they,
well, again, if they move from a carrier in Utah that's getting that Utah subsidy, and they move outside the boundaries of Utah, then they would not get that Utah subsidy, and they would just go back to the federal.
Well,
if they still qualify under the federal guidelines.
Let me, I think we understand the
situation.
Sort of the two or three yeah. points here. My gut feeling is we can probably deal with it under the eligibility requirements rather than the definitions, but we'll look into it. But I think we understand the points, mm-hmm. unless somebody feels that they've got something they haven't. I'm just looking at how many pages we've got, and I don't want to
yeah.
take too long.
Keep us moving.
Yeah, I'm going to keep you moving here if that's possible. Unless somebody feels like I'm cutting them off too fast.
No, I think you understand the concept and okay. figure out language, how to address it.
Okay, so we will plan on reworking the applicant definition a bit and possibly moving some of the things that we were trying to do with that to some other points. All right. Other suggestions or comments on other definitional?
I think Century.
Oh,
go ahead.
Oh, no. We suggested inserting a house, the definition for household.
Oh, that's right.
Because it's used in a number of places. And then that income, the definition for income referenced the federal definition. Because I believe it was a little bit different.
And lifeline definition, the income and lifeline definition.
Right.
Weren't tracking with the federal definitions.
The division also suggests that we also identify account holder as a, who should be the account holder. Because in some cases, the account holder could be different than the actual qualifying participant.
Okay. And the general comment and feeling among most of the parties is that matching, in terms of like those type of definitions, household, lifeline, program, income, account holder, to the extent we can match the federal, that makes sense to most of the participants here?
Yes.
I don't know that account holder is in federal.
It's not.
But it's a good...
Yeah. I'm just saying to the extent we can match.
Yes.
Yeah. But that's... Nobody has a problem with that general...
Right.
All right, very good, thank you.
John,
yes.
So are you wanting us to, like, URTA had a small change on the definition of ETC. Do you want me to go through that, or do you just want to, does the commission just want to look at our notes on that? We basically just said it's, eligible telecommunication carrier or ETC means telecommunications corporations that are designated as eligible telecommunications carriers by the commission or federal FCC pursuant to Section 214 of the Federal Communications Act. I guess what I'm wondering is, in this process, do you want us to, if we don't raise it here, is it not going to?
Oh no. We've read the comments.
I don't think there needs to be a lot of discussion on that.
I did want to clarify your comment on one thing. We included definitions of what we called federal ETC and state ETC just to recognize the idea that we have companies that may not be participating in both, and that they're going to be both behaving and treated somewhat differently. Do people have concerns with having both of those definitions, assuming that we clean them up a tad?
It may add clarification if it's defined as who is a state ETC.
meaning that they would be participating in the federal and the state.
Yeah.
And federal ETC would be federal only.
Yeah, we got both in there. Yeah. Under them. Okay. All right, we will consider those. And okay, section 3 then was the eligibility requirements.
I have a question. Sorry, okay. Back to the definition.
Oh, definitions? Okay.
Yeah, the responsible agency.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of get the feeling that that's like partly mine and partly the PSC. And I don't know if it's something that we need to separate. Yeah, it's, you know, so.
Isn't the responsible agency, are you talking about?
I'm thinking them.
Responsible agency would be the commission, but they, through contract, correct, delegate a lot of those responsibilities to EWS.
Yeah, I think we just would feel more comfortable if we had a more defined definition in what our responsibilities are. So that way we're because I don't want to say, oh, that's Shauna, or Shauna, that's, you know, her to say that's UTAP. So
we can certainly work on clarifying.
Okay. Appreciate it. Thanks.
All right. Anything else on definitions? Okay. On to the eligibility then, section 3. I know we got some comments here in terms of making sure we match federal definitions. We had tried, but as the comments point out, we failed in a few cases. But we will clean up what we can there. But general comments there, particularly in light of that earlier conversation on the eligibility concerns. But anything there people want to cover?
You have our comments on what we felt like the concern with. How you're informing the applicant of the penalty that can be applied, because the language mm-hmm. changed from the prior rule, where they had to sign mm-hmm. a statement.
Mm-hmm. And in your current comments, you basically would like that statement put back in.
Or
so
some
that
means,
clear, or some,
yes, there
so
has to be some means
they,
of informing them that they could be subject to a penalty, how the penalty will be applied.
Is that on the application? Yeah. Isn't there a statement?
It didn't say that in the
rule. No, I know, but we're just trying to see.
Okay.
I think the application, they try
current,
to have some
is.
Kind of statement.
The current application does have the statement in it. They would be subject to. Okay, I think this is, if you refer back, yeah, there's the certifications they include in the federal rule.
So you just want to make sure the rule says you've got to have that.
Right, right. Yeah. So that they, yeah.
And that's kind of in the.
Yeah, it doesn't tell how you disclose it to them, but typically the application's the disclosure to them. Mm-hmm. They have to fill it out and sign it.
Right, and the prior rule pointed out you must affirm it.
The prior rule was very explicit, and mm-hmm. it's probably a fine I didn't have, I would guess.
Yeah.
We can certainly clarify the process on that. Other comments on eligibility?
In our comments, we just pointed out, and I think others did too, that in A, in the very first paragraph, that where it speaks to self-certification, that for initial applications, documentation of eligibility is required, or a database dip, if you've got access to a database to verify eligibility. So that was a concern.
That's one of our concerns also, is that you have to, you can't self-certify for initial eligibility. You have to either check the NLAD or the access the eligibility databases or actually view the customer provided documentation.
Right. Okay.
And then also, I think several commenters talked about the last few criteria which qualified applicants for the tribal lifeline credits. And I know CenturyLink in our comments said that perhaps that did not need to be included here, since later on there's a section that says that the state won't be handling, or that tribal is outside of the state's consideration.
Right. And I guess we would like some, from you folks who do this for a living, some clarification on that. If someone had those type of documents to qualify but weren't going to be participating in the federal, they just wanted a regular lifeline phone, if they're not in the rule, how would that person qualify?
Those qualifiers are specific for tribal lifeline. They're not qualifiers for regular lifeline in the federal rules.
All right.
So if we had a tribal customer come to us, then they would go through the process consistent with the FCC, since the state wouldn't do that. Right,
right, but his question about the criteria, I think.
Well, my question is, what about a person who's a member of a tribe but for whatever reason wants a regular lifeline phone rather than going through the tribal process?
Yeah, then they would be... Because they don't live on tribal lands.
I don't know.
They have to also reside on tribal lands. So that someone who doesn't reside on tribal lands, who gets Medicaid, for mm-hmm. example, would only qualify for regular lifeline.
Okay. All right. Good to know.
If they get the tribal discount, the federal discount, though, they...
It's a one or the other.
In Utah, do they get... The ETCs
determine what discount they receive depending on where they're living. If they're living on tribal land and they have a home phone, then they get state, in the state of Utah, they get state and federal if they want it, but most of the time they want the tribal one because it's a lot cheaper. It's a bigger discount than what we would offer.
Mm-hmm.
And the ETCs would know that because I send over the address.
Okay. So if they come through you, you say, okay.
I approve them, and I know that they're tribal. And then a lot of them come from Frontier. So when I send it over to Frontier, Frontier automatically flags that, oh, this is on tribal land. And that's how they determine which discount to give. So I don't make that determination. I just approve or deny the app.
But see, she still has to do the eligibility testing.
So you tell them they're getting whatever state benefit that they're receiving, but that qualifies them for tribal also mm-hmm. if they're right. on tribal land.
Yeah.
So she'll still do eligibility for tribal or non-tribal. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah, so in order to get the state discount, they still have to come through them, mm-hmm. regardless of whether it's tribal.
Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that's been unclear to me. So the state will provide a tribal customer with
a state discount.
Mm-hmm.
But they
can get the additional federal discount of mm-hmm. $25.
And the ETC carriers are the ones that take care of all that.
Right.
I just basically, like I
said. Yeah, you say they're qualified for the state discount, and you send them back, and the carrier gets them on the tribal.
Right. Yeah.
Well, so
I think we're all learning a little bit here.
So the question is, then, they still would... Mm-hmm. They still would qualify tribal customers, not for the federal side of it, but for the state side.
And you got to remember, part on the reservation, if it's in city limits, they can't. They're not on tribal land. There's some areas that are like that.
Yeah.
So it really depends on the address, and a lot of times I wouldn't know.
You wouldn't know that. Yeah.
Mm-mm. The ETC would know that a lot better because they know their servicing area. So.
And I know we have a separate tribal application so that would cover the additional criteria.
And on top of that, you know, a lot of the times they could be on the Arizona side, but they've got a P.O. box in Utah. So, you know, I just, like I said, I just approve it and let the ETCs take care of it and decide and make that determination.
So I guess the question is, in the rule, do they still need stuff about tribal?
She needs
I do.
I was going to say,
for eligibility, yes.
because
if you can make that determination.
Any tribal assistance that they're receiving, we do not have access to. DWS doesn't. That goes to from Tuba City, Arizona. So, yes.
There, in the way the federal rules are designed for addressing federal, the tribal, is they're listed separately and specified as tribal.
Yeah.
So that may be what we need to look at for this. Because it says here are all the regular Lifeline programs, and then additionally here are tribal programs that may qualify tribal customers for tribal Lifeline.
And where's that found?
I think it's, I'm looking.
It just looked like you were looking at it, so we were.
Yeah, I'm trying to find it.
We appreciate that.
I think it's 5409.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, 54409.
4409.
All right, so let me attempt to summarize what I think we've learned from the parties. Is that because we still offer a state discount to someone, whether they're receiving federal, regular federal Lifeline or tribal federal Lifeline, there could be a need to have those things in the role, but it may, there wouldn't be any harm in listing them in the same way the Fed lists them, as long as they're there.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what I'm hearing? Okay.
I think we all learned a little bit.
I'm sorry. I got to state that I'm confused because if, as a landline provider, I have a customer who qualifies for Lifeline assistance.
Okay.
There's no state or federal distinction as far as what they get or they don't get. They get them both. Because the state program is set up.
Right.
That is how you get the federal.
Right.
So there's no distinction between.
Right. I mean, for you as a landline provider, we've got a requirement, we've always had a requirement, and I assume we'll have a requirement, that you can't participate in the state unless you participate in the federal.
Right.
But we've got two other possibilities. One is you've got a federal-only ETC.
Right.
And it could be a tribal customer, in which case they're going to get the federal tribal Lifeline instead of the regular federal Lifeline. Mm-hmm. But unless your service territory includes actual reservation addresses, right?
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't apply. That's what I'm understanding. Does that?
Okay, I'm all right. Well, you got the group that don't get the state. Federal, state, USF,
because they're like,
okay, they get federal,
right?
So there's no ways. They get federal or they get state. They get federal, and then you got the other group that gets federal and state.
Right. Right.
There's no distinction between
Over
here or over here. They're very clear to me.
Right.
So if we got
didn't sound clear.
Rosalinda sent the provider said, hey, we've qualified this customer for state, and it looks like they're a tribal customer. We would then have to do what we need to do to get them on the federal.
Tribal.
So they're either going to get federal, if they're not on tribal land, then they're going to get the federal normal Lifeline discount.
Right.
But you're still qualifying all the state portion of it.
Right.
And by qualifying them with the state, they may be qualified for tribal depending in the residency, I think, is the other issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right? It is.
Yeah, so that's what we've got to determine.
Does your form, because you get the form, does it include where a person has to certify that they're residing on tribal land?
There is a statement on there.
And they have to provide either their tribal number or their full social.
Okay. The issue is, I just don't know. If an inlet is going to play a big part in this, because they could have done, the tribal in Arizona, but yet, they could have done it in Utah. Mm-hmm. So inlet is going to be able to look at those for us as well. But right now, the ETCs are the ones that are really looking at those to make sure that they're not. And sometimes they don't catch them all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, and I wouldn't know because I don't have access to ETC systems. I don't know what they have or, if they're in that weird section where they're in a city or a county area where they shouldn't be getting tribal. I wouldn't know. The ETC would.
Yeah.
So I just do my part and said, hey, here you go.
Okay.
You decide which one you were going to give them.
All right. I think we can move on from that issue. No. Are there any other things under eligibility that people wanted to...
Hearing officer, this is Roger Moffitt for AT&T. If I could mention a couple of items.
Okay.
As you know, we've advocated generally in our comments that we think it is a simpler and a much better system in terms of integrity if you have the administrator do all of the eligibility determinations. So I'll just make my pitch once here that our advocacy is that the eligibility administrator, state eligibility administrator, would handle all of them, including for the Fed-only providers. I know that's a departure from the current system, but that's our advocacy, and it would be our recommendation for what it's worth. We think doing that, removes carriers who have an interest in getting customers from the process of determining eligibility, which we think is a step in the right direction, and that's why we make that recommendation. We also think it makes it a lot easier in writing these rules rather than having to draw distinctions for the Fed only versus the state lifeline qualifiers. If you can just have a simple uniform process, we've seen that work in other states. Nevada is one of them that I work in, and that's the system we have here, and we think that works rather well, and we would urge that. Moving off of that, we had one or two other items we noted in this eligibility section. One is that on the Social Security numbers, we think the federal rules only require provision of the last four digits rather than the entire Social Security number. We think that's a privacy issue for customers, and we would recommend that change. And I think this has been picked up in one or two other sets of comments on household. There's a rule in there requiring us to identify the relationship between the applicant and the qualifying household member. And also, this plays in, I think there's subsequent portions of the rules that require us to get information on changes in household. I don't think that's consistent with the federal rules. And going back to what we've been urging, as well as what we think CenturyLink was urging, in terms of trying to match the federal as much as possible, we think this is one of those areas where you should probably delete this rule in favor of keeping it uniform with the federal rules. And I think those are our separate comments.
Mr. Moffitt, this is John Harvey with the Commission. Just ask you for a little bit of clarification on one of your comments. We have a situation where the federal rules list certain programs that a household can qualify under which relate to the minor children in that household. If you have a situation where the household is using that program to qualify and that's what they're qualified under, but that minor child is obviously not the person who the account name is going to be in terms of who's getting billed for that phone. How, if we don't have that relationship between the account holder and qualifier, how would we deal with that situation?
Well, I'll let my SMEs chime in because I'm not sure I know necessarily the nuance there that you're hitting at, what the specific answer would be. I would assume, though, that the household would qualify for the program, not the child. In other words, if you submit documentation, it wouldn't just be in the name of the child, wouldn't it be for the family, and wouldn't it identify parents or something like that, which would be your applicant? I mean, the burden, after all, is on the applicant to show that they qualify for it, and as long as that remains the case, I'm not sure that the situation with the child would necessarily arise, but I'm going to let my SME speak for me if they have any further thoughts. Ann Bornhold, or Ann, are you on? Can you hear?
Yeah, I'm on speaker, so I hope it's coming through. My understanding is that if a child is the qualifying person, the household still qualifies, and on our application, the then ask for the name of the qualifying person. Does that answer the question?
I didn't hear your very last part of that answer. You said something with the name of the qualifying person?
Yes. On our application, we ask for the name of the qualifying person if it is not the applicant who qualifies the house as the left one.
So you would have both names then?
Yes.
And we do that too.
Well, then how does that differ from our rule then?
We're trying to do as a rule, though.
I guess I'm trying to understand the distinction between what we were proposing and what your practice is.
Well, I don't know that you need to identify the relationship in the federal rule. Isn't that the point, Ann?
Yes, we don't ask
the relationship.
We don't.
Oh, I see.
We don't get into what that relationship is.
You just have a record that they're a member of the same household.
That's part of the certification requirements, that they have to certify that the person is a member of their household, yeah. I believe.
But you don't have to disclose the specific relationship or why they're in that household.
Okay, understand.
Do you need that
though?
No. Hey, thank you for that additional information. I think we understand the issue now a bit better than we did. Any other comments on eligibility requirements that parties would like to make?
CenturyLink did make a couple of suggestions. One was in the section where the list of our income documentation, and that was just to, once again, sync those up to the federal language. And then added a bullet, it's C on our comments, but it's in order to constitute a qualifying low-income consumer must not already be receiving a Lifeline service. That, again, is coming from the federal rule. That just solidifies, I think, that
you only get
someone
one.
Can't have more than one Lifeline benefit.
Just state that explicitly. All right. Carol.
URTA had also suggested that the federal rules, I believe, require the date of birth of the applicant. So,
yeah, that would be good.
And Utah require full Social Security because of the way DWS's database is set up. So we need to add the term full Social Security, not last four digits in the rule.
And we just suggested adding a reference to the federal 54.410, which lays out all of the certification requirements under the federal rules, which includes things like the Social Security number.
Just a question for the parties then. If we did something like this, say we're referencing the federal rules and then list any additional state specifics, does that makes sense? Okay. Any other? Those are very helpful. We appreciate them. All right. Okay. Duties of responsible agency, section 4, and based on the earlier comment, we may change the title of that slightly. Clarify. But the intent originally around here was to talk about what at the moment would be DWS who has agreed to do this work under a contract. That's who we were trying to get at here. Like I say, we may change the format or title of that a bit based on the earlier comment. But with that in mind, comments on that section.
CenturyLink added some comments to include a query of the NLAD, and that's really what that additional language is in our comments is addressing, because somewhere in there that's going to need to take place, and I know that we're just, you know, other states are looking at accessing, where they have administrators are looking at accessing the database to do a query. Now, right now, USAC does not allow a state administrator to make updates on behalf of carriers, but our understanding is they can query to see if that person is already in the NLAD. So that would be something, it seems, that should be done by the responsible agency during the verification of eligibility process.
Yeah, and my understanding is that wasn't procedures, that's more of an oversight here, but certainly we would fully utilize the NLAD as much as we could. And I think that came up in various parties' comments, but yes, Carol?
Curious Lawson again. I thought this language, maybe I'm just reading it incorrectly, but I thought it was a little bit confusing. I'm not really sure what the difference in these two, the process, that is there going to be a different process for federal only and state and federal in this initial eligibility determination? And if so, what is that difference going to be? So I can see if
there will have to be.
How do you see that happening? What's the difference?
Do you want to talk to that, Rose, one time? Well, from what I understand right now, federal, you can self-certify, right?
Well, apparently we can.
It's not anymore. Okay. Well, in the past, it was.
The ETC has to verify eligibility. Mm-hmm. Verify it through the documentation.
The federal.
And do the initial determination if they qualify.
Yes, the ETC.
Where on the state federal, they're getting state and federal, then DWS would do that.
And so in number two, when it says the responsible agency shall verify the initial eligibility status of all new federal-only Lifeline telephone service recipients on a monthly basis and shall inform the ETC of its determination. What does that mean?
Well, I don't like that idea, but...
The idea, there's a difference between determining eligibility versus verifying eligibility.
Yeah.
All we're saying there is that the federal ETCs say these are the people that we've determined are eligible and we've doing the discount. This is simply housekeeping to say, okay, we're going to run them against the check to see if they're in a program. If they're not, then they check the income. But that's not the initial determination. That's just a verification. The initial determination has to happen by the federal ETC.
So a federal... ETC, a federal-only ETC would send over monthly the new ads to DWS, and then they would validate the verification. What they would do is the customer would send them the documentation. They'd validate that they're eligible based
on... Well, the carrier.
The carrier would send the
list.
But they're going to do a check after the fact.
Yeah.
Whereas landline providers, they get both discounts. We send them to DWS, and they send a list and add files to us.
Okay, and so how long, for the federal only, you're going to do that check once a month, and if it comes back that they're not, you can't confirm that they're eligible, or you can't verify it, whichever word we're using, then you will notify the federal only ETCs, and they will have to...
They will then work with their customers to find out if they're certified, they have additional information, if there's missing information. It was our intent that the ETC, the federal ETC, would do that follow-up and de-enrollment if necessary.
This is Eric with iWireless. In the scenario where we have submitted the data on a batch process to store the database for verification and the customer comes back as non-verified, I'm having a difficult time hearing you saying that at that point, has already reviewed the eligibility, that there's a process that you would like us for a dispute, if we've seen the proof of the program or things like that.
Okay, can you repeat just your last sentence there? I didn't hear the last bit.
Well, I'm trying to understand, and I'm having a hard time hearing the eligibility verification conversation. What I'm trying to understand is if the database so it's sent on a batch process monthly, the database, there'll be a return file. In the return file, there'll be customers who are identified as not eligible in the database upon initial enrollment. the ETC will have already seen their proof as part of our federal guideline. Is there, are you envisioning a process for dispute resolution or to confirm or deny whether or not this is actually a valid customer? How is that going to work?
This is John Harvey with the commission. We, in reading the comments, particularly from iWireless, that issue was brought up. The current draft of the rule, we agree, has some, I guess you'd say, holes in the sense that we haven't fully fleshed that process out. But we're aware of that concern. We think it's a valid issue, and we will definitely address it when we do get around to publishing a rule through the administrative rule process. We would like to hear today parties' opinions and ideas on what a proper way to do that might be, just so that we have, an addition to what we're thinking. The basic sort of two concerns that we'd love to hear information or ideas on, DWS as the keeper of, not the keeper, the administrator of all of the actual programs that these folks are qualifying under just about, they may well have a lot more information than the customer provided to the carrier in terms of what the actual household is, whether or not they're actually, currently enrolled, things like this. So we think it's certainly a real possibility that they might identify issues that a carrier missed. Not because the carrier is being negligent in any way, but simply because they have a different information set. So once that happens, we would like to get some input on how we design a process to deal with that. And iWireless can, since you started that, you're welcome to continue or whatever.
No, I appreciate the comment. I think what we've seen, the challenge, and I think I heard it in your opening comment, was that DWS would like, wants to need to approach us from a monthly batch process, so there will always be a challenge in syncing up the data and from a customer activity of an enrollment to verification of the batch, and then dispositioning the customer if they provided program proof that did not match the database. So I think the timing issue is the challenge. And if I understood you correctly, there's no interest to provide a web interface for more or some, maybe a nightly batch or some process to speed up the transaction time to prevent any misunderstanding of information that the customer provided or the data that's in the database. Is that correct?
Well, I think what I can say is DWS has expressed to the commission, and they're here, and they can correct me if I get this wrong, that for various operational reasons, they're simply not willing to take on the wireless aspect of this program. I'm not seeing them say that I'm wrong on that.
You're correct on that.
So,
he brought up the timing issue. That is the reason, one of the reasons why we don't want to take on wireless.
So I think one important thing to get to remember here is a carrier, a federal-only ETC carrier, that's following the federal guidelines and any other guidelines that come out of this rule, is not going to be in any trouble. It's just simply a matter of getting that record clarified on a going-forward basis. So we're just interested in trying to develop a process that, the carrier goes through, they issue the discount, the customer's got the account, it then comes back at a later date, maybe a month later, whatever, depending on what time of the month they signed up, that there was an issue the carrier didn't know about, and BWS doesn't think this person really qualifies, at that point we need to have some type of a process in place that resolves that situation. And that's all we're trying to get to.
So John, like for example, I know this isn't a wireline issue, but okay, so a federal-only ETC gets the documentation from the customer. Let's say they check they're qualified for food stamps. What other documentation do they have to provide pursuant to the federal to support that they're on food stamps? So whatever they provide, then I guess the wireless provider once a month would send it over to DWS and say, this is the name of the customer, here's the information, and here's what they qualified based on. You go in your database and you say, well, no, they're no longer, they just got dropped from food stamps. They're no longer qualified for food stamps. Then that's what you send back to the wireless and say, hey, you got an issue here. They said they were qualified for this. They may have provided you a copy of, you know, whatever they need to show they're on food stamps, but you just verified in the database that they're actually not qualified. Then you've got to have a process to say, well, do we go back to the customer and say, we've been notified that you're no longer qualified for food stamps. You need to provide documentation that you're qualified for another program or something.
Can we just use the de-enrollment process?
I was going to say that gets into the
federal de-enrollment process.
Well, so you de-enroll them and say, if you want to re-qualify, you got to go through the process.
That, or in the initial letter, it's identified that, you know, we've got information that if you do not respond within 30 days, you will be de-enrolled.
Same process.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what you were trying to accomplish, is those situation like that, right?
Why are you eliminating the dispute resolution that was in the original application? I mean, it's a Public Service Commission process that if someone, a customer, disputes something, they have like 20 days and they go through this other process. Why is that being eliminated here?
Go ahead.
The federal rule requires them to be de-enrolled within 30 days, and previously it was 60 days, and the commission rule previously matched the older 60-day federal de-enrollment period. And so now that it's 30 days, it's an awfully short time period to have multiple mailings going out. Mm-hmm. And so it's really, I think it's the 30-day time period.
Trying to match the federal de-enrollment process as much as possible.
The other aspect there that has been brought up in the discussions is that this is a de-enrollment without prejudice. They can always reapply,
okay, so,
which is equivalent, not grammatically but pragmatically, to an appeal.
This is Roger Moffitt. Can I ask for kind of a clarification just so I'm understanding this? You know, because I'm trying to understand how much we're saying that the federal-only ETCs are sticking out their neck, because as I'm understanding it, they're going to make the additional determination. And if they say this person is eligible, they're going to be applying the discount.
Right.
If they subsequently then hear back from the state saying this person is not eligible, does that have retroactive effect? Does that mean the discount that they've already been providing?
No.
Or is it essentially them being de-enrolled at that point? I mean, no. What is the? I'm trying to understand how you're understanding this legally to work with the state coming in with a separate verification and determination.
It follows the federal de-enrollment process. In other words, for de-enrollment, you find out you have information that someone's not eligible, then you start pursuing that de-enrollment process. Meaning that you've got to then verify if that information is accurate.
Well, and I think the one thing that, you know, I mentioned earlier is that if a federal ETC has followed the guidelines in place, then they're covered. It's just simply that there's different information sets available. But as long as they've been following the correct procedures and policies, they're not in any.
Well, as I read further down, you've got also this provision of continuing monthly eligibility where you're checking the databases. Would that sort of be the same thing? You're getting a list from a carrier of who's currently getting the benefits and you're checking?
Well, the contingent agency would have a list. All you do is just the adds and drops.
Yeah, for a wireless.
Yeah, but I mean, they're going to have, they have the full database.
But would the process basically be the same, except yes, you're getting the list from the federal only ETC in this case?
Yeah. The process would be the same if
that's what it
if it's a landline or a federal only. If DWS says their status has changed, they're no longer in these programs, then they notify the carrier. It's the same process.
And there's no retroactive. It's just on a foregoing basis. We go through the de-enrollment process.
Right. And
that's what I wanted to hear. There's no retroactive effect to the determination that the for the feds only that the discount can no longer apply.
That's correct.
Yeah. It basically becomes new information that you have about that person that they're no longer eligible because they're no longer getting benefits. So you go through the de-enrollment process to notify the customer, and that's something the agency will be doing?
For landline, yes. For wireless, the wireless would be
okay. Okay.
I have a question just for the DWS folks. If we have a customer who you check the database and say, no, you're not on that program, and they come back to their carrier and say, yes, I really am on that program, there must be something wrong in DWS's records. Is there an opportunity to, we probably need some process for them to contact you to clear up if there was
and that has happened today. I mean, that happens. You know, I'll have a customer, they'll mark that they're receiving food stamps, and I look into the system and there's nothing there. And then I will send a letter to them and give them 30 days to get back with me to provide that proof. Or, you know, you can call me. Maybe they wrote their Social Security number wrong. Anything could have happened. And so at that point, I wait and sit on that for 30 days or until, you know, until they call me. But it has happened. You know, there have been times where they will prove that one of their child does have Medicaid. And, you know, they're not in the system and come to find out that it was because they were under, the parents are separated, so they were under the other parent. And then they got custody, and it just never was switched.
So you're doing that, like before you would send anything to the federal ETC, you'd already be doing that, double-checking the information to make sure there's not an error on your side or, that, like you said, the way it's been.
Oh, I make sure it's squeaky clean before I send it to you guys.
Okay. Well, to the best of her ability. I mean, that's
yes.
But you said for federal ETC, but you're really talking about wireline.
They do a wireline too, right?
Well, and
you don't do that for wireless.
No.
Not just currently. Just landline.
Well, so with this new process for wireless, they're going to send you once a month, here's a customer we had, they were on food stamps.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to go into your database, you're going to check it,
mm-hmm.
and then you're going to say, we got a problem. And so they're going to have to do that reconciliation that you did for wireless, or for wireline.
Yeah, they're going to have to follow up with the customer. The responsible agency is not going to follow up with the customer for wireless.
And I think that's why they want a process, because they give you another Social Security number, you can double check your database.
Yeah.
You're not going to give them access to the database for them to do that. Yeah. So is there probably what they're wanting is some way so that the customer can interact with you directly and get that resolved.
And when does the 30 days start? I mean, does the 30 days for them to de-enroll a customer start from the letter or the notification they get from DWS?
It starts on the date the customer notice, whatever the customer notice is dated.
So if the wireless ETC is trying to work with that customer in the meantime, trying to clarify what the mistake, if there was a mistake, then that does the de-enrollment process is sort of in hiatus or something? And
you have that, they would not de-enroll that customer from Lifeline, according to the federal rules, for 30 days. And that would allow that customer a 30-day period to get back with DWS and bring their benefits up to speed.
But that's what I'm saying. So they don't de-enroll them for 30 days. I'm still not clear on when the 30...
The 30 starts when they notify the customer.
Okay.
That there's a problem.
But well,
it actually shouldn't it be, because we should do this in Nevada, the 30 days, I think, under the federal rules anyway, runs from the actual, not when the notice is received, but from the notice.
The date of the letter
is when the
day
is
printed.
The date of the letter.
Right. Okay, so when is the letter going to be sent?
That's what has to be established.
Yeah.
Right. That's not an issue here because it falls outside of the...
Yeah.
It falls back on the individual carriers. They have to have their
own wireless processes. It goes back to the carriers. They have to determine what that date is.
But it has an effect on the customer.
We're talking about a... I thought we were talking about a procedure between... so the it comes back that they aren't enrolled in the program that they said they were enrolled in, or there's an issue there. DWS is then going to notify the wireless company, and the wireless company is going to work with DWS and the customer before any notice goes out, or does a notice have to go out?
A notice probably would have to go out.
But not at that point, the wireless company would be taking responsibility.
Right.
So we've verified it. We've let you know the updated information. Now it's the ETC's wireless responsibility to then do what they need to do if they want to get any additional information from the customer or if they want to de-enroll the customer. That's, at least from our seat, that's how we're seeing that process. I guess I'm just wondering how long that process can just kind of meander on. The customer's still getting the discount even though we have information that they're not eligible for enrollment. I don't really want the wireless companies being able to go on and on and on trying to, you know, work through this process. I think there needs to, it may be the federal rules handle that, and I'm just not aware.
Yeah, see, I see a gap, and I'm thinking of this on a customer standpoint. Let's say they sent you, like you said, as an example, where there's a divorce and it's under this name. That's something that's... You can, they say, well, we do get these benefits. Well, how do you get these benefits? Well, I get it this way. Oh, okay. You see, and how is a carrier, they're going to say, hey, you're no longer, you don't qualify based on the state examination. They're going to say, well, the state's wrong. We do qualify. And so how are you going to reconcile that? Can the carrier really do that? So what I'm wondering is if there's a reject, I'm wondering if there ought to be a more expanded role of, I mean, you're probably in the best position to resolve that with the customer. And do that check, and then you let the carrier know we have...
The way I see it is, really, it wouldn't be. Because if I said, these people are not participating in a program, and send it back over to the ETC can notify that customer and say, sorry, we couldn't find you on these programs. However, you can still qualify by your income. And at that point, they have that option to bring that income in, and the ETC can see if they qualify by income.
But you're not going to qualify them on income, right?
No.
That's all documentation.
Nope. That's all documentation, yeah.
So I think...
So it's not going to really... I don't think it's going to be that.
Well, okay, let me...
Well, in that case, does the ETC have an the federal-only ETC have an obligation to go back to the state and get them to agree that the person qualifies? I mean, I guess what is concerning me here is there seems to be some ambiguity as to who becomes the eligibility and responsibility. I mean, who's really responsible for determining eligibility at this point? Are you saying it's still with the federal-only ETC and that the state is just kind of notifying them that you need to double check on this one,
yeah.
Or is it primarily reside in the state at that point that the ETC is going to have to go back to the state and convince them that yeah, this person really does qualify?
No, I don't think we're looking for you to send any information back to the state other than that monthly batch list that's required in the rules or as the proposed rules.
All right.
But no, well, the
case,
eligibility
the would run then from when the ETC then kicks out the note.
And don't forget,
the
customer also has the ability to go to DWS on their own or get online to show that they are on that program. They do have that ability, the customer themselves.
And how do they know that?
That's what I was...
Yeah.
That's what I was going to say. I think that's what I'm hearing is the missing link. And sorry for those on the phone, I'm in the back. So that's what I'm hearing is the missing link, is that if the ETC tells the customer that we've received information that you're not qualified, I think that's the missing link. They need, we as the state, as the PSC, needs to tell them exactly what they can do. They can either show income, or they can go work with DWS, because I don't think we want to put them in the position where the ETC has received information from the DWS saying they don't qualify, but then they get some kind of a photocopy or something from the individual that they do qualify. I think we need to give them very clear instructions on who says what when.
And I think looked at the federal rules. I think under the federal rules, once the state has made the determination that that person is not eligible, the de-enrollment process needs to start.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so the notice from the ETC needs to go out,
right,
and the 30 days starts, and the customer then knows that they have 30 days to fix this, or they will be de-enrolled.
But in the notice by the carrier, they can say, here's what you need to do if you don't agree. Here's some steps you can take, which would include being able to call DWS and saying, hey, you said I wasn't on food stamps, but, you know, whatever the situation is. I mean, otherwise, you got a customer that's kind of caught in the middle.
Right.
And they have to jump through more hoops to do income. If they're on a program, that's a lot easier to validate.
They also have a copy of their Medicaid. If they're on Medicaid, they have their Medicaid card that would show a date. So it's not like the customer wouldn't be able to provide that type of information.
No, it's just that you're dealing with some of the customers in this class of customer. They need extra help, as you know, to be able to figure things out.
Okay, let me step in here. I think we've certainly understood that there is an issue here. As I mentioned at the start, there's simply a hole in the rule where we didn't completely anticipate this. I don't want people to leave the technical conference today with the idea that this issue has been resolved, because ultimately the commissioners are going to make a decision and then see if they can get DWS on board with their decision. So we will take what we've heard back to the commission, explain that there's a really big problem here, that we've got to figure out how to both be consistent with the federal legal requirements in terms of starting these de-enrollment processes, but also make sure that we're protecting customers who may be in this limbo. So we understand there's a problem there, but we don't want you to take away that necessarily what parties have agreed to here is what the commission's going to decide. The way we wrote the rule is a little bit different than the discussion that just happened here, so we need to, there will be some changes. I'm just not sure what they're going to be.
I think 54405E will provide guidance on the enrollment when they receive notice. It doesn't provide a timeline from when they receive notice to when their notice to the customer has to go out. But, you know, one can assume in reading the rest of the rules that it's got to happen within 2 to 5 days.
Yeah, they're pretty quick.
So.
Okay, so we will address that, but I'm not sure how. But we are definitely aware that it has to be addressed when there's a problem. Was there a comment on the phone?
Response file back to the ETC, there's going to be two reasons why it would, the individual customer would be rejected. Either one, the input data, which I understand is really the Social Security number, doesn't match your record, or they match your records, but they're not in your database. And for us, if the ETC provides guidance to the customer, it's either you need to call DWS to resolve that you're not in a qualified program, or maybe the customer didn't provide their full social correctly. The last four would be validated with the NLAD DIP, but it may be the first numbers would not match. So I think we would need a response file with some kind of indicator of the reason for the rejection.
Well, the reason for the rejection?
Yeah.
That's a good point.
And next steps if they don't agree with the rejection. That's what Ms. Michelle was talking about. Just clear information to the customer on what they need to do.
And then a time frame on when the ATC has to respond to that. In other words, do they have 30 days to notify the customer, five days, or?
Well, we'll work on it. We understand there's an issue here.
What I heard is if we get notified, there'd be 2 to 5 days, we have to have a notice going out to the customer, and the clock starts running the minute that notice goes out. They have 30 days, then, and you tell them in the notice that they're going to lose benefits within 30 days.
All right. Other comments on, what were we on, duties of responsible agency?
You referenced the section, I think it's 405?
405E.
The de-enrollment, and that does address G, general de-enrollment, which is, I think, what we've been talking about, but it also addresses notification, like from USAC, or I think also that probably would encompass the NLAD, if someone was no longer, someone wasn't eligible because of duplicates, and then the de-enrollment due to the 60-day usage requirement and failure to recertify. So my suggestion is that we might want to look at that whole section and bring those, make sure those points are included in this de-enrollment process.
Okay. You did remind me of something with your comment. In the way we've currently drafted the rule under that de-enrollment, I mean, sorry, not the de-enrollment, but the section E, which was the participant switching between ETCs. We envisioned a bit of a process there, but a lot of the comments came back that said the NLAD should be sufficient.
Yeah,
I'm curious about people's opinions. Is there anybody that doesn't feel the NLAD would be sufficient, the NLAD process? I guess what I'm asking, can this be zapped, this section?
Well, one of the reasons why you're going to want to match that with the Fed, with the NLAD, is because there is, at the federal level, a five-day switching requirement anyway, which is already kind of a short time frame we're going to have to adhere to. So I don't think you want to build any more process remnant than you have to.
And so I guess I'm asking is just, of all those that are participating, is there anybody that would have qualms with that just completely deleting that section and saying that DWS is not involved in that process, it's just the carriers go through the NLAD?
But would the responsible agency be involved from the standpoint of what comes back to the carrier? Okay. Or the benefit transfer? Because we would enter the information, but I think they might be enrolled in or involved in.
They would get involved when the carriers then, when they submit their new ads or deletes, there would be a delete and an add, which would just change their database.
Right.
But that's all they would do, is just change their database.
Okay. Just as far as an informational exchange.
I think the rule needs to clarify that that's the process that would be used once we get between carriers.
Also, don't delete it, just say that it's NLAD.
You know, we're assuming that this is between wireline and wireless, but actually, I don't know, for example, in Idaho, there's, in some of our area, there is a wireline ETC through a cable company owned by an independent telephone company that's, so you can conceivably go between wireless to wireline as well. Mm-hmm. And that could happen in Utah.
Not currently, but it theoretically could in the future.
Well, I figured if it happens in Idaho, it can happen.
John, we had an issue on 4C, annual eligibility verification.
Was that the timing issue?
On the data, the 497 data. I mean, basically, the rule as drafted says the annual eligibility verification shall be performed on a participant list current as of December 31st. But I think what my understanding is that the FCC requires the ETCs to use the Form 497 February data, which is either submitted in March or April, depending on whether the ETC files its form on a monthly or quarterly basis. That data should be used to establish the baseline of subscribers who must be recertified. Basically, what I'm being told, and I certainly am not the expert in how this 497 is filed, but what I'm being told is if the Utah rules require a participant list that's current as of December 31st, then the ETCs need to assess which customers
as of December 31st, were de-enrolled prior to the submission of the February 497. And so we're basically having to modify the data each time.
Right. So in terms of, and just for clarification here, in terms of the Form 497, that's the form that the FCC is standardizing on for its for the carriers to report the annual verification results?
No. The 497 form is the reimbursement form that they use in order to get reimbursement from the vets. The 555 form is what they have to report their recertification results with.
And when is
and
that?
And on the 555 form, it requires a number from February 497 form.
Ah, okay. So the FCC is tying it to that date.
Right. Yeah.
But in actuality,
what
they're coming back to, because they say use your 497 for this, the form 555, which is the annual recertification report, is filed the end of January. So the 2014 information will be filed in January of 2015. So that'll show all of our recertification results for the year. So
So what gets filed in, say, January 2015 is for your recertification efforts for 2014, which was based on February 2014?
The starting point, they said, is your February 497 data. But you got to back out anyone who was added in 2014.
So they're trying to get to a year end.
So they're trying to get to, yeah, that's where I was going.
So
with
wasn't
it.
Our rule just going to where they've got to get to?
You also have to back out customers who, this is Tanae for URTA. You also have to back out those customers that were, claimed on that 497 that were customers as of December 31st, but then he enrolled at some point throughout the year. Before the recertification was conducted.
Well, what I'm trying to understand is it sounds like what is reported on 497 is a year-end number.
Well,
is that wrong?
Not on the 555.
No, on the 497.
No, the 497 is not a year-end number. It's a cumulative number for anyone who was added, who currently receives Lifeline through the date the form was, that the carrier took its snapshot. For that month.
Yeah, so reimbursement.
Basically, like our February 497, we take a look at the customers that are receiving Lifeline benefits at a point in time.
But what's that point in time?
Usually the end of the month.
It varies by company.
Ours is a billing cycle.
Yeah. So it's based on their billing cycle.
So, but it would include for what the federal guidelines are is, start with that for February 497. So that's going to include some current year activity. But you're right, you're going to get back to basically, for purposes of research vacation, anybody who went on prior to 2014.
Well, I guess I'm trying to figure out is what can I write in the rule that says when does the carrier need to submit this list and what is it? And then when do they have, when's it going to be done? As long as I don't care what it is.
I just want to know a number that we can use. USAC is doing recertifications for a lot of customers, and May 1st is when they're requiring their list to be sent.
And that would be the Form 497 list by May.
And it.
We can't hear the person on the phone. Can you get a bit closer to your phone and try again?
So we can, any time in 2014, we can recertify our customers who were on our subscriber list at the end of December 31st, 2013. You can do it any time during the year, but it's a specific list of customers that we recertify. I think in your rule, you should allow us to dip the database, the set of customers as required by the FCC for recertification. And cannot have a timeline of when it should be done. It can be done anytime during the year for recertification.
But it's still as of December 31st. You've still got to get back to your December 31st date.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And the only reason I think some of us that commented on this talked about tying it to that Form 555 is for ease of reporting the information. I think we all realize that it is really getting back to that December 31st list. But if we can tie that list that we have to pull of subscribers, and we would need to identify those that are 2014 editions or no longer on Lifeline, because those would be one, and then anybody who's left would be those that the state would need
to look at. So essentially what you're doing is you're saying, okay, I want to start with my February 497 number minus those who were added between January and whatever that number ends up being, to get back to my December 31 list.
And then that's
the list you're going to send us, or do you want to send us the list? Do you want to send DWS the list that is inclusive of the 497 number?
I don't think it matters to us. It's whatever you want us to send.
I mean, it may ease the process to just say, send us a list that equates to your February 497 beginning number. And then we don't have the confusion about, well, you got to take this out and this and got to add this. You got to.
And that is what USAT requires, I'm pretty sure. Is that
right?
Entire
they do require that February.
And then you have to just show on there, these are the ones you don't need to look at because they were added in 2014.
Right. So then how much time would you need in order to provide that data? If you were using the February 497 number,
I think
and
May
you provide
1st
a list that
doable.
Equates to that number.
But you know, like I said, I think USAC's using May 1st, and that to me, I'm just throwing that out because I think that's a doable number.
May 1st.
I don't know how everybody else feels about it, but that seems reasonable.
Well, I guess a thing that we would like clarified, given that the state has, I can't remember the legal term the FCC uses, but the state assumed the responsibility for, there's something there.
When what, there's a state administrator.
State administrator. What obligation does the state have to do the annual verification versus the carriers?
We have to complete certifying the December 31 participants by December 31st of the next year.
And the state has to do that, not the ETCs.
Right.
And that's for
and
both
provide
the
that
federal
information.
Only and the
yeah,
state?
Provide that information to the ETCs by December 31st of the following year.
It's only for the federal, it's only for like the landline.
In actuality, since we're sending a data dip to you, we're sending our entire bits to you every month. Every month you are confirming the eligibility. Mm-hmm. When we send our subscriber list at the end of February to you, or in the month of February, and you confirm that essentially acts as confirmation of the subscribers that we have that are eligible, who met the requirements for recertification.
If you're sending a full list.
By you returning the file that the subscriber is eligible, that they are eligible, that subscriber who would qualify or it should be counted on the recertification numbers does pass the database dip. Just through your monthly batch process, we've already been notified. I don't think you need to do anything extra.
Well, yeah, and our understanding of writing that rule was that where we are doing this monthly process, we're effectively just designating one of those months as the annual certification, that there isn't anything different. So I think that's correct, but our question is sort of what one do we designate as much as anything?
And that's only if you're sending a full list each month. If you're just doing a partial list of new ads and takeouts and stuff, then there's not a full list that would be provided.
Under B, when we're talking about continuing monthly eligibility,
mm-hmm.
It says the responsible agency shall verify on a monthly basis the continuing eligibility status of both state and federal ETC Lifeline
telephone service participants who qualify based on program eligibility.
That was where I got confused.
I guess we're not, I'm not clear, is it a full list or is it just the new?
And are we sending any of the list?
Well, my understanding in terms of when we drafted this, and this could be a wrong understanding, so I'm asking for clarification. DWS had as one of its objectives for this program administrator role was to build a database that when you send in the adds and deletes, or they approve adds and deletes for the states, that that was current. And so their database should match your customer base. And that they would just simply have a computer program that's going to check eligibility for everybody in that database.
Okay, so
they're effectively doing.
But the point.
Wait, we've got to get you closer to your phone. We can barely hear you. Or a better phone or something.
Discussion earlier that said that how does the ETC get notified to remove a subscriber and how do they communicate that to the customer? So the issue is if we're only sending part of a partial database, just the customers that are added, how would we notify somebody that was deleted?
Well, you're notice sending your adds and deletes.
And maybe we need to define that monthly process compared to the annual process.
From our perspective, from a landline's perspective, we're going to get the adds and the deletes from the Department of Workforce Services. So a delete would be your database says someone dropped off a program, so they're no longer eligible. You'll send us a delete on a monthly basis. But the rules require us, the federal rules require us, to do this annual verification. We can't assume that because of what we're doing on a monthly basis, everyone's data is correct. We're required to do this.
I would feel more comfortable.
We're just absolutely required. There's just no, so we just have to do it. We can't assume that every month what we're doing it qualifies for the federal requirement of an annual certification.
Well, I think because we're precluded in looking at that point in time for the 497, that's a specific list that's defined, and that may be different from what you're looking at on a monthly basis.
Well, I guess I'd say as a commission, we're interested certainly in minimizing any extra work that ETCs have to do to be able to report back to the FCC. And so if there is a way that we can match these up or use one of our monthly processes, we're interested in hearing about that. And we're certainly not opposed to that. But it does sound like there's some technical language that needs to be worked out a bit. So if anybody has ideas, they can certainly feel free to send them. All right, anything else on that section, which one was responsible agency section? It's been suggested, and I said at the start of the meeting, that we would take a break if we hadn't got very far, and I think we're certainly in that situation. So we will take a personal break for 10 minutes maybe, and then we will start back up. Thank you.
I know I've seen your name on emails or whatever with Carol
Gillespie.
Uh-huh.
Give them names, they take
them away. Yeah. Okay. All the time. Yeah, all the time.
So, Rosalinda, when you, where's your office? Is it on State Street?
It's on DWS, just across.
Oh, yeah, just right there.
Oh, yeah.